British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, Burnaby-based nonprofit organization the Down Syndrome Resource Foundation is providing new employment opportunities for clients. Danny Nesvarandi at CJSF has more. A food charter is in the works for local food sovereignty in the Prince George, Plenty Today area. Ian Gregg at CIFR Radio has more. As the federal election campaign enters its second week, Heather Watson at CHLY Nanaimo speaks with candidates who are excited to start the campaign in the riding of North Island Powell River. That story coming up. And it's candlefish season on the Nass River, and the Niska are cooking up a storm. I dive into that for CICK News in Smithers. Stay with us.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvarandi, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. The Down Syndrome Resource Foundation, or the DSRF, is a Burnaby-based nonprofit organization that provides group programs for youth and adults with Down syndrome, one-to-one services for individuals and families at all stages of life, and Down syndrome resources to equip parents, caregivers, and professionals. One of these main services is their employment service program, which has been proven successful in connecting clients of the DSRF that are looking for work with local businesses looking to hire. To learn more about the program and the reasons behind its success, CJSF reached out to Adrian Masters, the employment specialist for the DSRF, for an interview on this employment support program. Please take a listen.
I got an opportunity right out of high school to work with people with disabilities. I was like a summer coordinator, and I got to do really fun things kind of all summer with a variety of different people. And that sort of sparked my interest in working with people with disabilities. So I geared my education towards that. I actually came to SFU and minored in learning and developmental disabilities and a major in psychology. But in one of my minor courses, a professor of mine actually works at DSRF. And she was like, we're always looking for volunteers. So I went there and volunteered for a summer, and I just knew that that was where I had to work. So when I graduated, I reached out to them and got a job. I was a teaching assistant originally, and I was working with our young adults, and when they were graduating from our young adult programs, I noticed that almost none of them had jobs or were obtaining employment, and they're all hardworking, smart, driven, you know, they want employment. So I went back to school to become an employment specialist. That I graduated in 2020, unfortunately, so that was a bit of, you know, the whole world was on hold, but so for the past like 2 or 3 years is kind of when things have really kind of progressed with the employment program and the things that we're offering there.
Can you kind of run by the process that the DSRF goes through when it comes to connecting local businesses with the people in the program?
Mm-hmm. So when I work with clients, I try to find what they're interested in and then what area of the city they live in, and then ideally matching those things together, you know, close to home and their interest. Not always possible, but I do my best. So currently it's sort of cold calling employers, seeing if somebody's hiring, if there's interest. I have a couple clients who have really successful employment, very inclusive. They're doing really well. They're like part of the employment family of where they're working. And those people called me and were like, we have a place, or we're excited to explore. I'm hiring somebody with Down syndrome. So that's what I kind of thought, doing those one-on-one calls, that's great for a couple clients, but it doesn't really hit on the like larger systemic barriers around employment. So trying to reach larger groups of people that are hoping to be interested in employment.
Are there any specific examples that you could give of like a success story or something like that where, you know, the work that you're doing really showed a positive result?
Yeah, so I'll give you two, actually. One is recently in Burnaby. I went to a Burnaby Board of Trade event, and I connected with some people from a retirement living home. And a couple weeks ago, maybe about a month and a half ago, a client of mine is now volunteering there once a week for happy hour, where they serve drinks and snacks, and my client goes and he helps with that service. And it's made like a really big difference in the retirement, the home there. You can see the clients or the residents are really happy. My client is thrilled to share what he does when he comes back. And actually just this morning before I walked in, I got an email from his employer there saying that it's, he was looking forward to seeing the client and it's his favorite part of the week. So that is just awesome. It's nice to see, you know, success around employment. And then there was one in Vancouver, a coffee shop, who they contacted me looking to hire somebody with Down syndrome, and he's now been working there. It's been 2 or 3 years, and they are their family. He goes to their like private events that they have, their friend groups. They have lunch. The owners have lunch with my client and his mother. So it really is just like a, you know, it worked really well. It's just, they're completely part of the community.
One thing I was curious about had to do with the skill building mm-hmm. aspect of the work you do. How does that work? You know, like, because obviously there's going to be a wide array of things to work on. So where does that skill building capacity come from with the DSRF?
So the DSRF, we offer, our goal as an organization is like support across the lifespan. So infants come in and do feeding and occupational therapy and speech therapy, reading therapy, sexual education, kind of all across the lifespan. So, you know, we're trying to get individuals starting earlier talking about employment. And that means, you know, practicing asking for help and doing independent things in the kitchen or dressing or things, you know, when they can be independent, doing those things. Talking about jobs out in the community. So, you know, if you go to the coffee shop, looking at the barista or the person making the drinks, or if you're at a grocery store, the person stocking and the person, and pointing out those things. So we're a bit more aware of kind of building those skills earlier. In terms of direct work that I'm doing with clients, they'll come, you know, with differing skills. A lot of, we talk about like personal hygiene is good, being on time for work, you know, relationships at work, because that can be tricky. What are, you know, friends versus coworkers, and where does that line, where's that line drawn? Talking about appropriate conversations, so different topics that are appropriate for different coworkers. So those are some of the general skills that we talk about, and then working with a client if they have specific skills, if it's working at a restaurant, being a host, practicing those, you know, communication skills and stuff like that, so it can be geared towards the client.
In interacting with these businesses, are there any sort of misconceptions that you've come across that you've had to sort of quell as part of your job?
I think there's a lot of bias around hiring somebody with a disability in general. I think businesses are scared kind of how to dip their toes in. They're not really sure what accommodations might look like, what sort of things that they're going to have to change in their business to create a space for this individual, when really there's not many things that are different. And actually often if I make materials or training visuals or something for one of my clients so they can, you know, get better access at work, employers are often, like they mentioned, they're like, oh, this is great for future employees. And it's that sort of universal design for learning, where if it's good for one person, it's often good for the kind of the majority. So I would say kind of the fear of the unknown. And then, yeah, just not really knowing where to get started with accommodations or what that might look like for somebody.
Once again, that was our conversation with Asia Masters, the employment specialist for the Down Syndrome Resource Foundation in Burnaby, BC, and the foundation's employment support program. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Waging her way through an illness in Prince George, BC. Joining us over the line today is Rowan Whitakis. Thank you so much for joining us today. A part of maintaining a healthy lifestyle and becoming more resilient to sickness is, of course, nutritious and local food. Would you agree, Rowan?
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Thanks again for picking up the line today. There's a nasty bug going around, but I'm happy you could make a moment for us here at C4 Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You are advocating for local food and local food sovereignty with your most recent project, Food Systems North, PG. Would you care to describe your organization and some of the players who are involved right now?
Yeah, so I'm with everyone at the table, Prince George. We're a food system, food security, food sovereignty organization in Prince George. And we work a lot of different projects, like on the ground and in different forms to invest into the broad scope that is a food system. And one of the projects we're working on right now, we've called it the Food Systems North PG project. So this project specifically, we got funding for to work to support a local food charter and food policy council. So those essentially are working at trying to bring the community vision together and forward to inform like food system investments and also bring key food system and also us as eaters kind of together to inform action that takes place to enhance our food system and create a food system that is servicing our community and us as eaters within it.
Who is supporting your activities financially? Who is the grant through?
This grant was through the Public Health Association of BC. They put out funding in the fall, and that funding went out. All of the North could apply for it.
Sounds like you're in a position to get some things done. And this is a fairly nebulous environment, the area of local food production, food sovereignty, but you're trying to connect some of these disparate elements, not just the people producing food, but also people consuming that food. You know, who are some of the stakeholders that are involved? Who are you trying to bring together and who's on board?
Who are the stakeholders? That would be, of course, us as community members and eaters informing, but it also would be food producers, it would be food distributors, it would be local food providers such as restaurants, food processors, it would be food access organizations that are providing services, it would be other community food groups that are running food programming. It would be connecting with Northern Health. It would be connecting with the municipal government. It would be connecting with the regional district. It would be trying to bring all the different parties together to be connected, have conversation, know what one of each other are doing, to all be on the same page of being aware of what the needs are and how we can all work together. This project we're referencing, like a food charter and food policy council, but ultimately these are just trying to work to better the food system at large. So the input from anyone and everybody, like all community members, all organizations, like all professionals, all people working in the food system, big or small, will be very valuable to informing this project and what we're going to share out afterwards. So I would encourage everyone to come to the events or send us an email through our contact or on Facebook or reach out to us. And we're also happy to meet one-on-one. Yeah, just love to hear people where they're at and what they'd like to see. The food system is a touch point in everyone's lives, of course, but then also throughout community and throughout our economy. So with these projects, like a food charter is essentially a visionary document that can help guide future investments. So a lot of food charters might be connected directly to the municipal government to help guide actions, but it can also help with like research, food research, but also food organizations that are trying to invest in local food systems. It can help guide like what are the identified priorities, where are there opportunities to work together and collaborate. And then the Food Policy Council is more so would be that action group that kind of works to hit the ground with those ideas. So Food Policy Councils, that's where it comes in bringing all, like you mentioned, like the different stakeholders in a food system together to do work on these projects. And so at large, both of these, the main goal is to get everyone together in terms of informing and speaking to what the needs are of the food system, what might be lacking, where are the barriers, and to have a really like comprehensive view that is community informed that can guide where future actions happen, because a lot of the influence comes in, of course, from like external actors, external food system influencers, and large corporate entities that really have a big say, whether we want to or not, in how our food systems are operated and what they look like. So this would be more of bringing that back to the community voice and values that can inform investments.
The activity that you're undertaking here, it isn't just spontaneous. It's something you've been working on for quite a while. And actually already there is a Facebook group that is 1,100 people strong, the Prince George Food Hub. And part of this activity is kind of gathering all this interest in food security and local food sovereignty and getting some direction behind it, if I understand that correctly. And you're hoping to corral it into an event, an online event. Can you describe when that event is and just what the intention of that is?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, there's been a lot of amazing work that's been taking place in our community for a long time. Like the local Food PG Society and April Audison started that Facebook group you referenced. And so it's building off of that momentum and off of a lot of informed need for more connection and collaboration and an organization. And so this project, we are going to be hosting a few events. And these are going to be like open house events, invitation to anyone that can attend, that will be taking place in the community. So two of them are going to be in-person events, and then we are going to provide an online option as well. So we have one open house taking place on Monday, April 14th. That will be from 5:30 to 7:30. And this one's going to be focused on informing that food vision for our community that could help structure the development of a food charter. But really, it's just a great opportunity to get people together to have that conversation about where our food system is at and vision where it could be to inform that. So this is going to take place at the Aboriginal Housing Society. And then we're going to have a second workshop that's going to happen on Monday, May 12th. Also from 5:30 to 7:30, and this is going to build off of the first one, and this one's going to be more focused on developing that food policy council. So like what action could take place to in response to that vision that would come from the food charter or that visionary document. So this would be what an action group could do. So that could be food programming, that could be advocacy, that could be engagement with the municipal, provincial, or federal governments. Like it could be so many different things. But that event will be happening on May 12th, and that one's going to be at the Prince George Native Friendship Center.
Oh, thanks so much for your time, Ron. I hope you feel better soon. I hope you're doing all right.
And all right.
Bye for now.
You too. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is ACHLY and CBOX News Update. The writ dropped on Sunday, March 23rd, launching Canada into its next federal election period, ending the anticipation for local party candidates in North Island Powell River. This is the first federal election following the redistribution of federal electoral districts that took place in 2022. And one notable difference for the North Island Powell River riding is the addition of East Courtney, shifting the boundary line to include all neighborhoods east of the Courtney River. Another change this election period for North Island Powell River is that current NDP MP Rachel Blaney will not seek election again after serving the riding for nearly 10 years. She said in a press release March 27th that she looks back on this time with, quote, immense gratitude and pride, and that, quote, it has been an honor to serve as the representative of this region. CHLY and CBOX spoke to candidates in the North Island Powell River riding to hear how they are feeling going into the election. First to respond was the NDP's new candidate, Tennille Johnson, who said she has been eager to start campaigning.
I'm excited. I'm feeling great. I'm a planner at heart, so kind of waiting. The waiting period for the writ drop was something else. So I was super excited when it was finally official, so that we could all just get started and get moving with it. I think a lot of people have been kind of anxiously awaiting the election and that same decision as to when it was going to happen. So it was almost like a sigh of relief, and then let's get going.
Also quick to reply was the Green Party candidate Jessica Wegg, another first-time candidate who also says she is excited.
I am feeling excited. I'm excited for Canadians to have this opportunity to vote at such a crucial time, especially when we can see just how important it is for citizens to participate in the democratic process.
Liberal Party candidate Jennifer Lash is also running for the first time and is excited about the conversations she has been having with community members so far.
I'm feeling so energized and excited because of all this momentum towards the Liberals, and it is just a really exciting time to be out there talking to people about the future of the communities in North Island Powell River. We have communities from big to tiny and a wide range of them, and they all have certain issues that they want to address. They're concerned about the tariffs, they're concerned about economic development, they've got concerns around health care, but they're coming with ideas, they're coming with a willingness to try and find solutions and work together on things, and I'm finding that just exhilarating and exciting. So it's been an amazing first couple of days of the campaign.
Paul McKnight, returning candidate for the PPC, thanked the newsroom for reaching out but said he will not be giving interviews at this time and suggested listeners read his bio online. Aaron Gunn, first-time representative of the Conservative Party, did not respond to the request for comment before the publication deadline. Biographies of each of the candidates will be linked in the web version of this news story, which can be found online at chly.ca/news. Electors have until April 22nd to register to vote or apply to vote by mail, either online at elections.ca or in person at a local Elections Canada office. Elections Canada has offices throughout the North Island Powell River riding in Campbell River, Port McNeill, Comox, and Powell River. Electors may also visit these offices to vote early by special ballot before the April 22nd deadline. Advanced voting will take place April 18th through 21st, and Election Day will be on Monday, April 28th. For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on CSK News, in the early spring on the Nass River, ulikan are running. This little oily fish, which is known as the candlefish, is also known as a life-saving fish because it was the first fresh food to arrive in the river after a long winter and has caused for much excitement in the Nass Valley. Camps are set up along the river as a base so Niska harvesters can set nets in the middle of the river and smoke and cook the ulikan, which renders its oils. Not long ago, that oil was more valuable than gold. Nicole Morvan is the Harvest Monitor Coordinator for the Directorate of the Niska Fisheries and Wildlife. CICK News had a chance to catch up with Nicole in the Nass Valley as crews prepare to process the thousands of ulikan caught this season so far. As the run comes to an end, Niska members, young and old, gather at the camps to process the ulikan and prepare for a plentiful harvest.
Nicole Morvan from Niska Fisheries and Wildlife in the Nass Valley. I've been working on the ulikan project for the past 16, 17 years here in the Nass Valley. Our Niska Fish and Wildlife program is a stock assessment program, so part of that is doing the ulikan project. So we work with, we have 7 camps down there, but currently there's only 4 camps open right now. So I work with those camps that are there to collect our data. I also get to watch the process on how everything's done as I sit and wait for, you know, biosamples. So biosamples are me getting out and taking the ulukin and taking them back and processing, doing sexing them, lengthening them, taking otoliths. And then also getting to watch the full process of not just like the fishery, but the grease making of the ulukin fishery. So, yeah, and right now we're at the point where all of the bins are full. So once the bins are full, they have to wait at least 9 to 10 days, depending on the weather. Sometimes it's shorter, sometimes it's longer. And then once the ulukins are ready to cook, that process is probably like an 18-hour process, something like that. It's like over a two-day period, pretty much. It's just getting the bins ready at the same time as waiting for them to be ready for cook. Yeah, so right now I'm going to head down there tonight. They start the grease cooking, so I'll have a little bit of video about that and see how that goes.
Amazing, Nicole. That sounds super cool. As you remember, you know, I was up there a couple of years ago, so I got a firsthand experience watching the ulukin being harvested. Maybe you can tell us, one, a little bit about the Nass River and then also about ulukin. What is ulukin, and when do we usually see ulukin come up the river? So tell me a little bit about the Nass first, and where do you see these ulukin coming in?
They come in just, you go towards King Colas, so I don't know if anybody knows where the Nass is. We're about 100 kilometers north of Terrace, BC. So you'll drive about 1.5 hours to get there, and you'll see the signs along the side of the road. It's called the Otset. They call it Fishery Bay. You'll see the sign there on the left, I believe, when you're coming down the hill. So that's in between Lakogup and Gingolf. And then the ulukin itself, the only way I could really describe it is like smelt. I've never tasted smelt myself, but a lot of people are like, when I tell them it's like smelt, and they seem to know what smelts are. We call them our savior fish. So when our winter stock is like dwindling down, and then we turn to the ulukin harvest, which happens in March. So pretty much the whole month of March, our crews are down there for that whole month harvesting and preparing. So then we're prepared for the next winter and only taking what we need. And yeah.
I also noticed this year that the crescent moon was pointed upwards.
Yes.
What does it mean for the Niska if the crescent moon is pointing upwards, the spoon, as it were?
They want to see that point of the moon like that. We call it Hovie. We celebrate that. So that tells us whether or not we're going to have a good harvest. And this year was a good harvest, but only 4 out of the 7 fish this year. So we'll see. Yeah, we got what we needed, basically.
Yeah, no doubt. It sounds like a busy time, but also as you're saying that, I'm getting excited because I know that spring and summer is just around the corner.
Yes, yeah, for sure. It should be good. It'll be fun.
Well, Nicole, that's all I had for you. Thanks so much for giving us the time and your insight, and good luck with the rest of the ulukin harvest and the rest of your season.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative. We'll be right back.
Good day.